Blog Talk Radio.
We will not bow down to our racism.
We will not bow down to
injustice.
We will not bow down to
exploitation. I'm gonna stay.
Live and direct. This is your host, Seek Wisdom. And I'm excited about our show tonight. Tonight we are going to be doing part two, long awaited, part two, We Speak Their Names. And tonight we speak the names of sisters who do not get mentioned much, you know, to try to give our other sisters out here some education on, you know, just what black women can do. We are amazing in all aspects and all arenas and every way, shape, or form. Tonight, we will speak the names of some sisters who are in the Black Panther, who were in the Black Panther Party, or affiliated with it in maybe some way, shape, or form. So, let me open up my co-host line tonight. We have Sister Earth co-hosting. Let me see if I can get the line freed up. Pieces, how you doing?
I'm good. How you?
I'm good. I'm good. Let me see if I can turn my volume up on my phone a little bit. All right. And for everyone who might be listening out on Facebook, if you could come on over and join us in the chat room, we are at blogtalkradio.com/blackwomaniverse. So you can come on over and sign in on Blog Talk Radio so you can chat with us in the chat room. I want to give a shout-out to everyone who's in the chat room. You know, peace and blessings. Thank y'all for being here listening. And peace to everybody who's on the line. So without further ado, I guess we could go ahead and get started. Of course, after we talk about these sisters we're going to talk about tonight, I have a topic that's going to go right along with this that we could discuss. So we'll touch on it when we get to it, though. I'm going to speak about Regina Jennings. Regina Jennings became interested in the Black Panther Party at age 16. And I'm going to be reading some information from something she wrote. The title of what she wrote, I believe, was Africana Womanist. Anyway, she is an assistant professor in the Department of Africana Studies currently at Rutgers University, the founding editor of the Journal of Black Poetry, Echoes of New Voices and Visions, and the Critical Journal of Black Poetry, Literature, and Critical Analysis. She's also the author of Midnight Morning Musings, Poem of an African-American and African Sun Imagery and Poetry of Phyllis Wheatley. And she has the forthcoming works, including Race, Rage, and Roses, as well as some other things that we'll probably get into later. Anyway, she became interested in the Black Panther Party at age 16. And these are her words. I knew racism and police brutality intimately, and I had no knowledge of understanding of sexism. I was raised, as most black women of the 1950s and 1960s, to accept male dominance and to consider myself as a helpmate to men. I joined the Black Panther Party because I wanted to smash American racism. As a result, when the Panthers emerged, they answered the whispers of a long-lost prayer. In this article, I intend to revisit the circumstances that encouraged me to join the Black Panther Party and the double standard for women that I found there. However, this is not a sorrow song of a victimized woman, but rather my attempt to point out the tragic flaws or incorrect behavior of the men in the party. I somehow knew that they were practicing a form of oppression rooted in their own centuries of powerlessness. Hence, when I met sexism, I tried to lift the bedroom out of their mind. Some in leadership positions were sexist, and this unchecked problem weakened the foundation of the Black Panther Party, which compels me to write to alert young activists, brothers, and sisters to their history. With full information, perhaps past mistakes will not be future repeats. I found that part of what she said very, very interesting. Anyway, she joined the Black Panther Party with a serious drug habit, and with a personal directive to, quote-unquote, kill white people. Again, this is words. When I first showed up at the Panther headquarters in Oakland, California, I was asked why I wanted to be a Panther. I said I wanted to kill all the white people. That's why. I was dressed in my best weight and leather outfit and was supporting a most pronounced cabaret hairpiece. The officer of that day must have been familiar with all types of people stating outrageous reasons for wanting to join the Panthers. After my outburst, he calmly took my name and number and said someone would get in touch with me soon. On leaving the Panther office, I moved around the Bay Area, discovering the ambience of California and the new country accent lingo. It never occurred to me why I was glorifying in the language, music, and aesthetics of my people that I was being followed. As the Panthers checked out my Philadelphia and Oakland address, they also followed me for well over a week. Some concluded that the FBI sent me, but the captain assured them with salty good humor that she's too stupid to be from the FBI, quote-unquote. He thought my cover and my comments too honest, too loud, and too ridiculous to be serious. My captain accepted me into the party, and then my struggle from drug addict to soldier became a hard-fought personal war. The Panthers, like many people in the black community, understood my drug dependencies, and under the captain's leadership, they helped me to abandon the addiction gradually. Never having particularly enjoyed history taught in school, my attitude in the party reversed. The Panther way of teaching caused new recruits to devour history books. They taught us from an Afrocentric perspective, whereby the needs and interests of African people determine our perception. This Panther behavior predates Molefe Asante's development of an Afrocentric paradigm and perspective. It demonstrates how he and Hudson Wing studied African behavior throughout the diaspora and based their findings in a theoretical construct of Afrocentricity and Africana womanism, respectively. I never considered black people as a subject of knowledge, and viewing phenomena from this perspective awed and attracted me. I'm going to skip around in what I'm reading here, but I want to read that to kind of sort of preface a little bit about, you know, her background. Anyway, she goes on to say that the void I used to fill with drugs was now filled instead with pure and noble love for my people. In the next paragraph, she gets into how, I'm going to read this one because this is important. Hudson Wing writes of the importance of the black family to the black woman. The black community was similar to a type of extended family. Brothers and sisters in the Panthers regularly subsumed our needs for the betterment and the maintenance of the organization and our goals for the black community, self-sufficiency. As Hudson Wing writes, the Africana woman is less inclined to focus primarily on herself and her career at the expense of the family and its needs. This did not infringe on my so-called individuality. On the contrary, I felt extremely alive in the vortex of creating a new future for my people. It is African to believe strongly in family, forcibly, as Mercy Amba Oduyoye writes in Daughters of Anoma, African Women and Patriarchy. The more women made others comfortable and dependent upon them, the more they feel alive. Moreover, Hudson Weems asserts the Africana womanist is committed to the art of mothering and nurturing her own children in particular and humankind in general. All right. The rest of what she's writing here is that she wanted to be a soldier from the beginning. When she came into the Panther Party, she had no intent on trying to, you know, hook up with any other brothers, although she had, you know, love for everybody within the party. You know, sister and brotherly love, she didn't have any intent on, you know, being anything other than friends and comrades with the people and the men that were inside the party. Her captain, however, started coming on to her, and she kept refusing his advances, and, of course, he made her life miserable. He gave her ridiculous orders. He shunned me. He found fault in my performance. During the early years of the Black Panther Party, there was no democratic procedure for challenging an officer. Although I sought redress through the Central Committee, the officials of the committee sided with my captain. The all-male panel agreed that I should not behave as a bourgeois woman and bring such values into the party. They believed that my attitude of sexual abstinence was both foolish and counter-revolutionary. At that time, I lacked the maturity and skills necessary to challenge authoritarian men, and so I searched for ways to circumvent my captain's sexism. I was determined not to leave the party because I felt there was no other American space where I could fully be my black revolutionary self. Moreover, even though the captain was completely incorrect in his constant harassment, I still loved his commitment to black people. I knew that this brother and all of the party brothers had my back, quote unquote. I saw their contradiction and their patriarchal banditry, and in seeing their disoriented realism, I decided to try to redirect their thinking. After a year of transforming myself into a soldier for black people, I found that my captain searched for greater ways to push me out of the organization. He felt that I was not a good influence on other soldiers, especially the females. He felt that I was defying orders. When I refused to quit the party, he developed the perfect plan to get me out of his unit. He transferred me to the national headquarters away from Oakland and away from all that had come that I had come to know and appreciate. Regrettably, I experienced some kind of vicious sexism all over again. There were women who came through the party and would immediately leave because of the vulgar male behavior. Though there were women in the party like me who tried to hold on because they understood the power, the significance, and the need for our organization. Black men who had been too long without some form of power lacked the background to understand and rework their double standards toward the female cadre. Perhaps if the party had external observers, community elders who respected our platform, such unfair practices against women may not have occurred or could have been curbed. However, all men in the party were not sexist, and I must emphasize this for an Africana womanist. I am interested in both truth and in my total race. The captain and those in authority like him were narrow, foolish, and inept leaders. Male Panthers who disagreed and challenged the males in authority were ostracized. Sexism was a significant factor in weakening the structure of the Black Panther Party, and men and women fought it. It is important to understand and recognize the proclivities among men, especially as we move toward the 21st century. New leaders, new faces are proclaiming public power. Because black women, for the most part, desire male companionship, non-sexual or sexual, and because we are, as Hudson Weems writes, whole and authentic, our rights must be respected. The thing I got from what I just read about Regina Jennings is, to me, I respect her speaking out and everything, but I still feel as though she probably could have said more about what actually went on. It seems a little bit to me as though she tried to cover it up a little bit. However, the main thing is she stood out. She joined the Black Panther Party because it seemed like it was a good idea. You know, in terms of helping the community, she participated with a lot of food programs. I didn't read her write-up in its entirety, but she did speak about their breakfast program and how, you know, oftentimes a lot of the Panther members went without eating to make sure the community ate and that the children were fed. So in researching a lot of these women, you see their dedication and the things they put up with just trying to do for their people and for their cause. They went through a lot. So that's the overall tone of what I got from the research on some of these women. Sister Earth, did you have anything to add?
I just wanted to say that seems to be the reoccurring theme. It's, you know, women, black women especially, seem to be put in a position where it's like, I mean, even in our personal lives, but going to the whole, quote, movement or whatever and whatnot, we're put in a position like, you know, we can see the big picture. Like, we need to move forward. We need to get out of this type of system. But unfortunately, it's always to our detriment. I mean, always. I can't think of a time when it's not to our detriment either. You know, when we start reading about these other women, some women put up with stuff for years, and they were actually being physically assaulted by high-up brothers in the Panthers that, you know, we learn to respect and read their books and, you know, scream black power about and this, that, and the other. And so it's like we're kind of caught in this position where it's like, you know, we still kind of, I guess, long story short, we still coddle our brothers. Like, we've gotten to the point where we pulled a big mama on them, like, hey, you know what? I was going to say pull your skirt down, but you know what I mean? We've never got to that point where it's like, no, you know, I'm going to spank you, get the belt, go get the switch, I'm about to whip your ass because you're not acting right. So, I don't know. We're always stuck in that kind of position. That was really the only thing I have to add. And it's funny that with the exception of, like, one or two, all women kind of went through that with the Black Panther Party. Afeni Shakur,
yeah.
I remember her saying stuff about that, and a few other notable Black Panther women. But yeah, that's pretty much it.
All right.
Okay. Well, I am going to get on my girl, Kathleen Cleaver. Now, I'm going to skip around as well because a lot of the information, you know, I know pretty well, but there's certain things that I don't really want to skip. So what I really want to do is start with her, let's see, what do I do with it? Start with her actual achievement before I get into her story. Okay. Okay. She attended Oberlin College in 1963 and Barnard College in 1965. And then she went on to Yale University, got her bachelor's in 1983, her law degree in 1989. She was a high coordinating officer for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, campus program secretary in 1967. Was the communication secretary of the Black Panther Party. She also co-founded the international wing of the Black Panther Party in 1970. She co-founded the Revolutionary People's Communication Networks in 1971. She worked for a law firm, Kravitz, Swain, and Moore, as an attorney, 1980-1990, a clerk for prominent African-American judge A. Leon Higginbotham, in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third District in 1991. She was assistant professor of law at Emory University in 1992-97. She also was a visiting professor at Cardozo School of Law, Yale University History Dean and African American Studies Program, visiting faculty in 1998. She moved on to Sarah Lawrence College, professor of public policy in 99. Then she went back to Yale Law School as a senior research associate in 2000 to the present. She also founded the International Black Film Festival, and she's also worked on quite a few documentaries about not just Black Panthers, but other things. So long story short, my girl Kathleen, she's not a lightweight. Okay, so this is Kathleen Neal Cleaver. Okay, Kathleen Neal was born May 13, 1945, in Dallas, Texas. Both Kathleen's parents had higher education. Her father was a sociology professor at Wiley College in Marshall, Texas. Some of you guys may be familiar from The Great Debaters. Her mother had a master's degree in mathematics. Again, I want to say her mother had a master's degree in mathematics. Soon after Kathleen was born, her father, Ernest Neal, accepted a job as the director of Rural Life Council of Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. 6 years later, Ernest joined the Foreign Service. The family moved abroad and lived in countries such as India, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and the Philippines. Kathleen returned to the United States to attend a Quaker boarding school named Philadelphia. She graduated with honors in 1963. She continued her education at Oberlin College. I already got into that. So anyway, as part of the Black Panther Party, she was in charge of organizing a student conference at Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee. At the conference, she met Minister of Information Eldridge Cleaver. After she met Eldridge Cleaver, Kathleen moved to San Francisco in November 1969 to join the Black Panther Party. Wait, let me get one part. Okay, Kathleen and Eldridge Cleaver were married on December 27, 1967. Cleaver became the communications secretary and the first female member of the party's decision-making body. She also served as spokesperson and press secretary. Notably, she organized the national campaign to free the party's Minister of Defense, Huey Newton, who was jailed. In 1968, the same year her husband ran for president of the Peace and Freedom Ticket, she ran for California's 18th State Assembly District, also as a candidate of the Peace and Freedom Party. Cleaver received 2,778 votes for 4.7% of the total vote, finishing third in a four-candidate race. As a result of being a part of the Black Panther Party, the Cleaver suffered some acts of violence. The Cleaver's Apartments was raided in 1968 before a Panther rally in San Francisco by the San Francisco Tactical Squad on the suspicion of hiding guns and ammunition. Later that year, Eldridge was wounded in a shootout between Panther members and the police. Eldridge was charged with parole violation following the incident. Real quick, I just want to throw into there, that's also the incident where Bobby Hutton got killed. He came out of the house. The police surrounded wherever, whatever location they were, and Bobby Hutton came out first with his hands raised, and they shot him 12 times. Anyway, so Eldridge was charged with a parole violation following the incident. He decided he did not want to face another incarceration and fled the country. Eldridge spent 7 months in Cuba and was finally reunited with Kathleen in Algeria in 1969. She gave birth to her first son, Maceo, soon after leaving Algeria. A year later, in 1970, she gave birth to their daughter while the family was in North Korea. In 1971, Huey Newton, a fellow party member, and Eldridge had a disagreement. This led to the expulsion of the international branch of the Black Panther Party. The Cleavers formed a new organization called the Revolutionary People's Communication Network. Kathleen returned to promoting and speaking about the new organization. To accomplish this, she and the children moved back to New York City. The Algerian government became disgruntled with Eldridge and the new organization. Eldridge was forced to leave the country secretly and meet up with Kathleen in Paris in 1973. Kathleen left for the United States later that year to arrange Eldridge's return and raise a defense fund. In 1974, the French government granted legal residency to the Cleavers, and the family was finally reunited. After only a year, the Cleavers moved back to the United States, and Eldridge was sent to prison. He was tried for the shootout in 1968 and was found guilty of assault. He was sentenced to 5 years of probation and 2,000 hours of community service. Kathleen went to work on Eldridge Cleaver's defense fund, and Eldridge was freed on bail in 1976. Eldridge's legal situation was not finally resolved until 1980. After his legal situation was resolved, Kathleen went back to school in 81, receiving a full scholarship from Yale University. She graduated in 1983, summa cum laude, with a Bachelor of Arts degree in history. In 1987, Kathleen divorced Eldridge Cleaver. She then continued her education by getting her law degree from Yale Law School. After graduating, Cleaver worked for a law firm and followed this with numerous jobs, including law clerk in the United States Courts of Appeal, faculty of Emory University in Atlanta, the Benjamin Cordoza School of Law in New York City, and graduate school at Yale University. In 2005, she was elected an inaugural Fletcher Foundation Fellow. She then worked as a senior research associate at the Yale Law School and a senior lecturer in the African American Studies Department at Yale University. She is currently serving as faculty at Emory University School of Law. Now, one thing I do want to touch on is a part of an interview that I found. And so basically in this interview, she's asked a couple of questions, basically about the Panthers. Why did they fall apart? And, you know, looking back on it, you know, would she do anything differently? So anyway, the first question was, why did the Panthers or the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee Coalition fall apart? She said, I think it was totally misunderstood on both sides what was intended. When Stokely Carmichael was drafted by Huey Newton in May of 1967 as a member of the Black Panther Party, he was very proud of it. He went around showing his scroll. SNCC had a central committee that made decisions. Stokely Carmichael was becoming very public and highly noted, notorious person, more so than anyone in the SNCC had ever been. So there was a lot of conflict in the SNCC about how decisions were being made. The Black Panther Party had a very small, tight central committee, and decisions were made by consensus. And the consensus in the Black Panther Party was that the SNCC should be merged into the Black Panther Party. This was not discussed with the SNCC. So when James Forman was drafted as Minister of Foreign Affairs and Rap Brown as Minister of Justice and Stokely Carmichael as Prime Minister, this was not something that had been ratified nor discussed by the leadership structure of the SNCC. And so the failure to understand the two organizational differences plus some intervention on the part of police agents made it sure that it collapsed. It led to the disintegration of it. So the next question is, in 1997, you now have graduated from the Yale Law School with the highest honors. You clerked for the most distinguished black jurist alive, the Honorable Leon Higginbotham, and you've been an associate at Kravitz, Swain, and Moore, which many people would say the heart or the inner logic of the capitalist system. In retrospect, were the Panthers right? She responded, yes, yes, we were right, but that's not enough to be right. That's not sufficient to be right. Tom Paine was right, but the American Constitution didn't reflect his views. You have to have institutional, corporate, financial, military power. And on the other hand, you have to have the mass support of the people, their hearts and their minds and their beliefs. Now, the revolutionary positions that we took were not consistent with the beliefs of the majority of the American people, because the majority of the American people believe in the system as it is. They just believe the system didn't work right, but it should work right. What we believed is the system was fundamentally corrupt and can never work right and had to be replaced. Now, the educational effort that it would take to transform the society is something that the resources at the disposal of handfuls of youth organizations could not accomplish. We could have accomplished a far broader educational effort had we not been so viciously sabotaged and attacked by a broad array of police agencies. The FBI had its police against us. The CIA had its police against us. The DIA had its police against us. Everyone had their own police against us. So the forces arrayed against us, not to mention our own internal confusion and dissension, the youth organization coming into being in 1966, in which maybe less than 1% of the people were over 25. We would have to expand and incorporate broader and broader segments of the black community and align ourselves with broader and broader segments of the working class and radical white community. We would have had to take 3 and 4 generations to do this.
Anyway, I'm going to stop right there. Now, most of this information on Kathleen found off of the internet, and you know it's her bio and things like that. But if you do a quick internet search, you will also see that while she was, you know, it just briefly touched on some of the things that she did for Eldridge. What they conveniently left out was, it's a known fact that Eldridge Cleaver was not organized whatsoever. She did everything for him. When they said that she was a co-founder, you know, really, Eldridge was a co-founder in name only. She did all the organizing. When he had to come back to the States and face that prison time that he was going to get, she's the one who raised that money. And we're talking, I don't have the exact number, but I think the last time I looked, it was something like $70,000. And we're talking about $70,000 in the late 60s, early 70s. You know what I mean? That's not a chump change. And so anyway, Kathleen did all of this stuff for him, you know, coordinated his movements in and out of the country, you know, really did a lot for him. And she stuck with him until I think I said 87, 83 or 87, something like that. She stuck with him for a long time. But what they did not touch on these articles that were snatched off the internet was that Kathleen was actually a victim of domestic abuse by the hands of Eldridge Cleaver. Other sisters in the Black Panther Party had actually reported, you know, being in Algeria, I believe, or being somewhere, Korea, somewhere out of the country, and that Eldridge had beat her so bad that she couldn't participate in anything that was going on. She had to just stay in her hotel room or whatever and whatnot. And so, anyway, I bring that up just to show, you know, some of us on the phone, and don't get me wrong, when I first heard it, I was like, what the hell is wrong with her? But this still goes back to what we spoke on earlier. It's like, especially black women who are coming from the conscious community or whatever you, RVG community, whatever you want to define it, we run into stuff. Maybe it's not quite as terrible as what Kathleen was going through, like somebody actually putting their hands on you. But there's been times where you've been disrespected for nothing else except for the fact that you're a woman. However, if you match labor, you know what I'm saying? Like how much effort, how much energy, work that's actually being done, it's always imbalanced, and it's imbalanced on our side. Are always doing the majority of work with a little bit of respect from the brothers in there. And so,
right.
anyway, you know, I'm not bringing that up to embarrass her because she did leave. You know, finally she just got enough of it or whatever, and he was weird and, you know, running around campaigning for Meekum in Arizona, all types of crazy stuff. She did leave, so you got to give her credit for that. But I just wanted to point that out to show you how much of a sacrifice that she made. You know, Sister Sieg, earlier you said something about how can we only know about Hatshepsut and Harriet Tubman.
Right.
You know what I mean? Not that we didn't know about Kathleen and Angela, really, but we really didn't know what type of sacrifice they made. We're always looking at, you know, other women like, well, like Harriet, like, oh, God, this Patty Rollins would have got her and stuff like that, and I'm not taking that away. But could you imagine what it would be like when you know that you're sitting there coordinating breakfast programs and you're trying to help this dude not go to jail and this fool got enough nerve to put his hands on you, but you're in a position where it's like, dang, I'm trying to free the people. You know what I mean? Like, would this really be beneficial for me to be like, hey, this MF-er put his hands on me? Anyway, I want sisters to really think about that. Like, some of these sisters went through hell with these brothers. Maybe it wasn't necessarily physical. It could have been sexual, which is just as bad, or mental, having somebody disrespect you simply because you're a female. So anyway, I'm done with my rant. Did you have anything else to add to that?
All I have to say is double jeopardy in this situation. You're black and you're a female. And a lot of times, when we're dealing with things from that perspective, a lot of women, you know, depending on how they were raised or, you know, how they are, you know, mentally and emotionally, they may not feel comfortable speaking up about certain things. And depending on the type of people you roll with, quote unquote, when you speak up, certain, it's not necessarily welcome. You know, if you have something to say that's different or out of line with a lot of other people. But, again.
No, but that's exactly right. You are 100% right about that. It's such a catch-22 because even now, you know, sisters who are on the Black Universe who are listening to this, they know that I post stuff like, yo, these brothers, they did us dirty, they did us in, you know, whatever. But at the same time, it's not that I've forgotten that there's, like, another system in place to keep not just black people down. We need to start looking at the economics behind it, but keeping poor people down especially.
Right,
and,
right.
And, you know, I know that's still in effect. But I think where I am right now, and this is just my soul, you know, you can comment on it, you can disagree, that's fine. This is just where I am. I personally can't even... We can't elevate anywhere if there's animosity between us. I mean, what's that saying? A house divided against itself can't stand or whatever. There's no way that I can look a brother in his face and be like, yeah, let's get free together when my freedom ain't a part of your equation. So until we sit down and you say, hey, you know what? I left that toilet seat up. It's my fault. This is like this and my bad. We can't do nothing. We can't do nothing with them. So I think it would be at this point in time, unless, you know, some miracle happens, I think sisters need to start just getting it together for themselves.
My emancipation ain't. Don't fit your equation.
That's right.
As Lauryn Hill said.
Everybody's
trying to
crazy.
You know. All right. I'm going to get into Erica Huggins. And, again, this is a sister I hadn't heard of, like, ever. But let's see. Erica Huggins is a human rights activist, poet, and teacher, as well as a former Panther leader and political prisoner. For the past 25 years, she has lectured throughout the U.S., where her extraordinary life experiences enable her to speak personally and eloquently on issues relating to physical and emotional well-being of women and children, youth, incarceration, education, and the role of spiritual practice in sustaining activism and promoting change. Erica's political activism began in 1963 when she attended the March on Washington and committed to moving from the sidelines to the front lines in the global human rights movement. In 1969, at age 18, she became a leader in Los Angeles chapter of the Black Panther Party with her husband, John Huggins. 3 weeks after the birth of their daughter, Mai, Erica became a widow at age 19 when her husband, John Huggins, along with our princess, Butchie Carter, was gunned down in on the UCLA campus. Erica brought her husband's body to New Haven, Connecticut for burial and stayed on to open a new Black Panther chapter. Hold on, I'm trying to skip over something so I won't have to read everything. As a result of her 14-year tenure as a leader of the Black Panther Party, which is the longest any woman in leadership held, she brings a unique, complete, and honest perspective to much-debated challenges and successes of the Black Panther Party. Now, let me get into a little bit of her challenge and why she's qualified to speak on certain things. She was targeted when she came back to New Haven to bury her husband, and after she opened that new chapter, Black Panther location, she and Bobby Seale were targeted and arrested on conspiracy charges, sparking the Free Bobby, Free Erica rallies across the country. The resulting trial, one of the largest and most celebrated of the era, spawned several books. While waiting for trial for 2 years before charges were dropped, including time in solitary confinement, and this is what I thought was really amazing about this sister, she taught herself to meditate as a means of survival. From this time on, she would incorporate spiritual practices into her community work, teaching as a tool for change, not only for herself but for all people. A lifelong writer and poet, upon release from prison in 1972, Huggins became writer and editor for the Black Panther Intercommunal News Service. Her book of poetry chronicling her experience of imprisonment and liberation, Insights and Poems, co-authored by Huey P. Newton, was published in 1974. Her poetry and writings have appeared in numerous magazines and books. From 1973 to 1981, Huggins was director of the Oakland Community School, a groundbreaking community-run child development center and elementary school funded by the Black Panther Party. She created the vision for the innovative curriculum for the school, which became a model for and predecessor to the charter school movement. In 1976, Huggins became both the first woman and the first black person to be appointed to the Alameda County School Board of Education. In 79, 10 years after her release from prison, Huggins returned to California State County prisons and jails to teach Hatha Yoga and meditation through the Siddha Yoga Prison Project. A focus of her volunteer effort was her work with incarcerated youth. She has continued this work with adults and, in addition, has continued to teach in homes for foster and adopted children and pregnant teens. For the past 15 years, she has also taught relaxation and mindfulness in California youth correctional facilities, in addition to many Northern California public school districts and community colleges. In 1990, at the height of public awareness of HIV and AIDS, Huggins was the first woman practical support volunteer coordinator at the world-renowned Shanti Project. She also developed a unique volunteer program for women and children with HIV in the Tenderloin and Mission District of San Francisco. During her time at Shanti Project, Huggins developed citywide programs for the support of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and questioning youth with HIV and AIDS. Currently, Huggins is a professor in women's study and brings her legacy of spiritual activism and social justice to her teachings. And, yeah, that's all I have on Erica Huggins. The thing that I found that was interesting about this sister, hold on, did I skip over something? Educator and student, as an activist, former political prisoner, and leader in the Black Panther Party, educator and student, I have devoted my life to the equality of all, beyond the boundaries of age, culture, class, gender, sexual orientation, or ability. For the past 30 years, I have lectured across the country on issues relating to the well-being of women, children, and youth, incarceration, education, and the role of spiritual practice in sustaining activism and promoting change. And again, she speaks on her 14 years as a leader in the Black Panther Party. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure I didn't leave out anything. But the thing that I found most interesting about her was that she taught herself how to meditate while she was incarcerated, and she gives credit to that practice alone as her survival that got her through 2 years of incarceration and time in solitary confinement. A lot of times when we're dealing with activism, sometimes we tend to separate our spiritual practices from activism as though they're two separate things when they belong together. So that's the main thing I wanted to point out in reference to Erica Huggins.
Yeah, that balance. That balance is always where we need to go. Okay. Next person I am going to read about is Sonia Sanchez.
Now, before I get started, I just want it to be clear that she wasn't a part of the Black Panthers Party, per se. She, you know, she's a writer and a poet. She's been credited with, like, the Black Arts Movement. Now, she's been affiliated with different organizations that are dedicated to Black liberation as well as women's liberation. So, anyway, we'll get into that. Okay, Sonia Sanchez, poet, mother, professor, national and international lecturer on Black culture and literature, women's liberation, peace, and racial justice, sponsor of Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Sonia Sanchez is the author of over 16 books, including Homecoming, We Are a Bad People, Love Poems, I've Been a Woman, A Sound Investment, and Other Stories, Homegirls and Hand Grenades, Under a Soprano Sky, Wounded in the House of a Friend, Does Your House Have Lions, like the scene. Anyway, there's a lot more. She was also a contributing editor of Black Scholar, the Journal of African Study. She's also edited an anthology, We Be Word Sorcerers, 25 Stories by Black Americans. She's a recipient of the National Endowment for the Arts, the Lucretia Mott Award for 1984, the Outstanding Arts Award from the Pennsylvania Coalition of 100 Black Women, Community Service Award from the National Black Caucus of State Legislators. She's the winner of a 1985 American Book Award for Homegirls and Hand Grenades, and the Governor's Award for Excellence in the Humanities in 1988, the Peace and Freedom Award from the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom in 1989, and a Pew Fellowship in the Arts for 1992 and 1993, and a recipient of the Langston Hughes Poetry Award. Now, Sanchez was born Wilsonia Benita Driver in Birmingham, Alabama, on September 9, 1934. When Sanchez was only a year old, her mother died, and she was sent to live with her paternal grandmother. She then lived with family and friends until 1943, when she moved to Harlem to live with her father, her sister, and her stepmother, who was her father's third wife. In 1955, on a side note, I know you probably muted yourself out of speak, but I knew I was going to get, yeah. Again, I want to say, when she was a year, okay, let me just read that part one more time, just so it can sit with everybody. When Sanchez was only a year old, her mother died, and Sanchez was sent to live with her paternal grandmother. She then lived with family and friends until 1943, when she moved to Harlem to live with her father, her sister, and her stepmother, who was her father's third wife. Okay, the next sentence I'm going to read has nothing to do with that, but it is funny how they had to let you know that it was his third wife. Anyway.
Wow.
In 1955,
do you mean like his third wife, meaning he was divorced and then had married a third time? Is that what you mean?
Girl, I don't know what exactly that means, but all I know is if she was born in 1934, in 1943, that would make her 9 years old. So if her mother died when she was a year old, so that was like 1935, and only took that negative 8 years to get married twice. And furthermore, when her mother died, she was sent away for some reason. Anyway, but that's neither here nor there. We're speaking about Sonia now. Okay, I'm going to read it one more time, though, just so it sits with everybody. When Sanchez was only a year old.
No, no. You pass that part and go to the other part she was about to read, because you already read it twice, and I'm going to say something else. Mm.
Okay, in 1955, she received her bachelor's in political science from Hunter College in New York, where she also taken several creative writing courses. Later, Sanchez completed postgraduate work at New York University, NYU, where she studied poetry with Louise Bogan. Sanchez married poet Etheridge Knight. They later divorced. In 1972, she joined the Nation of Islam. Now, this part is important. In 1972, she joined NOI, the Nation of Islam, but left the organization after 3 years in 1975 because her views on women's rights conflicted with theirs. Sanchez has taught as a professor at 8 universities and has lectured at over 500 college campuses across the U.S., including Howard University. She advocated the introduction of black study courses in California. Sanchez was the first to create and teach a course based on black women and literature in the United States. Sanchez was the first presidential fellow at Temple University, where she began working in 1977, where she also held the Laurel Carnot Chair until her retirement in 1999. She is currently a poet in resident at Temple University. Sanchez is a member of Plowshares, the Brandywine Peace Community, and Madre. She also supports Moms in Alabama and the National Black United Front. Sanchez was a very influential part of the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Arts Movement. Sanchez was an advocate for her people. She was a member of CORE, Congress for Racial Equality, where she met Malcolm X. She wrote many plays and books that had to do with the struggles and lives of black America. Sanchez has added two anthologies on black literature. The first one I already read, We Be Word Sorcerers, and the next one is 360 Degrees of Blackness Coming at You. Sanchez is also known for her innovative melding of musical formats like blues and traditional poetic formats like haiku and tanka. She also tends to use incorrect spelling to get her point across. In 1969, she was awarded the Penn Writing Award. She was awarded the National Education Association Award for 11 years straight, from 1977 to 1988. She also won the National Academy and Arts Award and the National Endowment for Arts and Fellowship Awards in 78 and 79. It goes on and on. She was awarded American Book Award for Homegirls and Hand Grenades and a Community Service Award for the National Black Congress, the Lucretia Mott Award, the Governor's Award for Excellent Humanities, Peace and Freedom from the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Anyway, that's pretty much it, what I have, but I have to say that I've been a woman. You know, it's poetry, but that one is probably one of my favorite books, poetry books ever. So if you guys run across it, you know, go ahead and pick that up.
I'm just looking in the chat room. Somebody just my sister just posted a comment. What's funny is that she went to his mother's first and then went to live with her father. That's weird. No, it ain't.
Oh, in between the mother, then she stayed with other families and friends and then went to the father.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's worse, but.
Yeah, it's special.
Unfortunately, not unexpected, unfortunately.
Yeah, I wish I could say. I'm not surprised.
I'm going to leave Angela Davis for my last one. So I'm going to get into Denise Oliver Velez. Now, I had never heard of the sister. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying that you're taking that one because now I don't know which one I'm going to do because I only have one left after that. One woman left after that.
Okay, well, you want to go ahead and do Denise? Well, who are the next two you were gonna do? Denise and who else?
I was gonna do Denise and not Nyasha, but the other lady. I forgot her name that quick.
Okay, you go ahead and do Denise, and since I have some information on her too, we can kind of sort of swap, and then I'll do Angela Davis.
Okay. Okay, Denise Oliver Velez. Now, you have her information about what she's doing now, right? Like her job.
Yeah, I have a lot of her, I guess, more.
Okay, tell me what she's doing right now, because I know her history from the Young Lords and the Black Panther Party.
Yeah, I have some of that, too. All right, I'll read what I have now. Denise Oliver Velez is currently a professor of anthropology at Sunny New Paltz and ethnographer and data analyst for two AIDS research projects. The chairperson of WIMBA, a group of artists and activists based in Ulster County, New York, and a priest of Yemaya or Yemaya in the Lukumi Yoruba faith. She was the executive director of the Black Filmmaker Foundation, program director of WNYC TV, program director and co-founder of WPFWFM Pacifica Radio, and grants manager for the Minority and Women's Training Grant Program of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. She is also a former member of the Young Lords Party, serving as their Minister of Economic Development and the first woman on the Central Committee, and a former member of the Black Panther Party.
Okay, you touched on all that. Well, she was also, I'm going to start with this. Well, another thing that's interesting about her is that she is a Black woman, but she was raised in multicultural communities because she was also a member of the Young Lords. For people who are not necessarily aware of who the Young Lords were, they were basically another group, basically almost like the Black Panthers except for Puerto Ricans. Like, they did a lot in New York City to stand up for the rights of Puerto Ricans. Like, sometimes we forget, especially dealing with some of the younger Latinas and Latinos, that they are basically Black, too. Sometimes they forget that, too. But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just definitely agreeing. I had to be loud with that one, like, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes they forget as well. And so anyway, the Young Lords in particular were another group. I'll get into them in a second. I'll pull up that information. Let me pull hers up first. Okay. Denise Oliver was born in Brooklyn, New York, to African-American parents. Despite her African-American heritage, she became an honorary Boricua while growing up in New York neighborhoods that were heavily populated by Puerto Rican immigrants. Oliver is best known for her pivotal role in the Puerto Rican movement of the late 60s as the first woman to be elected to the formal leadership structure of the Young Lords Party. And just on a side note, that's actually pretty phenomenal, especially when you really get into the whole Latino culture and the machismo. Anyway, her early childhood experience predisposed her to join in predominantly Puerto Rican organizations, in part because of the racial temper of her early life was significantly different from the hardened racial nationalism that came to dominate activist politics in the late 60s. Oliver was raised in a highly political household during the 40s and 50s that exposed her to the multiracial and multicultural world of politics of the left of that epoch. Her godparents, for example, were social workers in the settlement house movement, and she also recalls that the first word she ever uttered was in Yiddish. Her father was an actor activist old left and a professor of English, literature, and drama, and her mother was a college graduate with a degree in chemistry and home economics.
A degree in chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that deep? Kathleen Cleaver's mother had a degree in mathematics, and this woman's mother had a degree in chemistry. Anyway, and somebody said that women can't do math and science. Okay, during her tenure in the YLP Central Committee, Oliver was Minister of Economic Development, and along with Pablo Guzman, the YLP's Minister of Information, contributed significantly to the production of Palante, the major news organ of the organization.
As one of the most articulate and confident members of the YLP, Oliver played a crucial role in redefining the organization's views on racial and women's oppression. Let me read that one more time. As one of the most articulate and confident members of the YLP, Oliver played a crucial role in redefining the organization's views on racial and women's oppression. Oliver was one of the primary architects of the internal struggle waged in the YLP that challenged male chauvinism and struck the phrase, machismo should be revolutionary, from Article Number 5 of the Young Lords Party 13-point program and platform. That addressed the issue of women's inequality. Oliver, along with a group of other women in the organization, challenged the assumptions of the mainly male founders of the Young Lords. These early organizers believed that they had adopted an enlightened form of machismo and had adequately addressed the issue of women's oppression when they wrote their mission statement in the fall of 1969. However, as more and more women began to join the ranks of the YLP, the organization was forced to confront its gender prejudices more forthrightly and eventually to change the group's mission statement to read, "We want equality for women, down with machismo and male chauvinism." Now that is deep.
Wow.
Now that is deep. If I could just get two of our own brothers to say that, I might start feeling a little different. I might. Anyway, Oliver also helped pen the YLP document entitled The Young Lords Position Paper on Women, one of the clearest political expositions produced by the organization in its early years. Although Oliver's contributions to the Young Lords were many, one of her most significant includes her challenge, alongside other members of the organization, to the racism in the group, as well as the unconscious racism embedded in Latino and Latina culture, language, and values. Okay, here we go with these Latinos. Once again, one of her most significant was her challenge, alongside other members of the organization, to racism in the group, as well as the unconscious racism embedded in Latino and Latina culture. Meaning that she, not only was she fighting with these people, you know, fighting for these people, whatever, she also had to deal with their little ignorant remarks. Anyway, her background.
Yeah, because she was quote-unquote black.
Exactly. And you look at her picture, anyway, that's a different story. Her background as a young lord with African-American roots who was influenced by years of experience in civil rights and black power movements afforded her a measure of authority and respect when she addressed issues of racial import. Prior to joining YLP, Oliver had been a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Congress of Racial Equality. In collaboration with her peers in the YLP, Oliver was among the activists who began to popularize a social critique of Latino and Latina racial transformation, racial formation that led to a political awakening on the forbidden issue of racism in Latin American society and Latino and Latina communities, which is deep. Okay, now that's what I have for her, but I quickly just wanted to go over this article that I have about the women of the Young Lords Party, because even though they don't want to admit it, they obviously are black. Puerto Rico is not a race. Anyway, Connie Cruz, okay, the title of this article is The Mujeres of the Young Lords. So Connie Cruz has been told what to do all her life by her parents, then her husband. That changed in December of 1969. Then a group of young Puerto Rican activists were appealing to a church in El Barrio, East Harlem, for space to house a breakfast program for the poor. The first Spanish Methodist church had denied their request. Its minister saw the youth as leftist rabble-rousers. But the group, the Young Lords Party, remained undeterred. They planned to put in another request during the church's testimonials. My brother-in-law, Mickey, came to visit, Cruz said. He explained the reasons for them being there at the church to ask the community to give up space for a children's breakfast program. I felt that was a very good cause to become involved with. But her willingness to act was not encouraged. My brother-in-law at that time said, "This is for men, not for women," she said. That stirred something in me. She put her timidity, her fear aside, and insisted on going to the church. Her brother-in-law, she said, then asked her what she would do about her five-year-old daughter. She said, "Well, I'm bringing her with me," Cruz responded. Cruz and the Young Lords took over the church and fed the poor, hungry children for almost 2 weeks until the police rushed in. That was one of the many actions the group would take. At 25, Cruz became an older member. Most of the Lords at the time were in their late teens or early 20s. But whatever their age, they all had commitment to challenging the status quo for Puerto Ricans in New York and beyond. The conditions they believed required it. Then the Puerto Rican community lacked the extent of leadership, organization, and clout that exists today. The city outright neglected neighborhoods in the Lower East Side, East Harlem, South Bronx, all heavily concentrated with Puerto Ricans. Deplorable housing conditions, police brutality, racial and ethnic discrimination in services was the order of the day. Bilingual education was not mandated in schools, and even basic health service like tuberculosis testing was inaccessible. Across the country, young people were taken to the streets to protest the U.S. war in Vietnam, and throughout the world, the liberation struggles against colonialism. And let me skip to the other part. Okay. Initially, the group served as the Northeast branch of a gang-turned-political group from Chicago. In New York, the Lords were wearing purple berets, quickly landed on the front pages of major newspapers with their takeovers and face-offs with the police. But on a day-to-day basis, the Lords engaged in community organizing to demonstrate that everyday individuals can stand up to abusive landlords or police officers or a neglectful environment. Okay, let me skip to the part that has to do with the women. Okay, the Young Lords were governed by an all-male central community. The 13-point platform advocated for revolutionary machismo. The women began to caucus out of the group's El Barrio office. They talked about personal experience and studied Puerto Rican women in history, from workers advocate Luisa Capetillo to nationalist Blanca Canales. The line on the revolutionary machismo became a focus of discussion and sharp criticism. We fought against the idea of revolutionary machismo because we said, what is revolutionary racism, Morales said. When we started meeting, we were told that we couldn't take time to have the silly women's meeting, said Denise Oliver. And that's what I just read about, Denise Oliver Velez, another former Lord. Most of the members were Puerto Rican, but there was also a Cuban, Dominican, and a Black American member like Oliver. The women defied the party leaders and demanded change. Their pressure resulted in the revolutionary machismo line being dropped and in women being added to all levels of leadership. A new point in the program began with, we want equality for women. That was machismo and male chauvinism. Anyway, the women, long story short, the women basically organized everything. They started the defense ministry. They started the newspaper in this group. They structured this group into a military structure. Orders from women leaders had to be followed regardless of the attitude towards them. And when they weren't followed, it was brought up in the party's practice of open criticism sessions. Insubordinates would also face discipline. So my point of getting into who the Young Lords were, even though sometimes we separate ourselves from other things because we got our own problems to worry about and then you don't want to deal with ridiculousness from a Latino. But at the same time, you got to give these women credit because they didn't just take that shit. You know, they didn't just coddle their men like, you know, baby, I know you haven't had no power, so I'm just going to take this right now. The Black woman, the Cuban, and the Dominican woman was like, hey, what exactly is this machismo you speak of? Anyway, I think that's pretty dope.
Definitely dope. It's just amazing what a lot of these women did in their time.
And the other thing that we forget about a lot of these women, and this is something that we forget about Harriet Tubman, too, all of these women that we talk about were young women.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it's all, you know, you need a balance, you know what I mean? I'm not saying it's all on the young women, but you just got, I know in my situation how retarded I was, especially in my early 20s, who knows if I could have got anything like that together. So I give respect for those young women getting it together. You know, I was retarded at 20. Who knows what the hell I was thinking about? I couldn't even imagine trying to organize something. I could barely organize myself. So you have to give these women credit for being able to do that. Not only organizing a party, but putting these chauvinist males in their place.
Agreed. Very, very much so.
right. I'm going to go ahead and get into Angela Davis. And this is going to be it's going to be a long one.
Hey, you can't leave out the story about when they were on the manhunt for my girl and how they found her. You can't leave that
I'm going to let you tell that when I get there.
Okay.
All right. Angela Davis is an American socialist, philosopher, political activist, and retired professor with the History of Consciousness Department at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She was the director of the university's Feminist Studies Department. Davis was largely active during the Civil Rights Movement and was associated with the Black Panthers. Her research interests are in feminism, African-American studies, critical theory, Marxism, popular music and social consciousness, and the philosophy and history of punishment in prisons. She wrote about the FBI targeting of the Black Panther Party as a part of its COINTELPRO program. Angela Davis, born on January 26, 1944, is a radical activist primarily working for racial and gender equality and prison reform. And she was born in Alabama. I can't speak. What is wrong? She was born in Alabama and a 1965 graduate of Brandeis University. Davis worked as a philosophy lecturer at the UCLA during the 1960s, and during which time she was a radical feminist and activist and a member of both the Communist Party, USA, and the Black Panther Party. Hmm. Was she a member of the Black Panther Party, or was she affiliated with them?
She was just affiliated with it. She was never a member. Now, she was a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee at one time. But she never was a card-carrying member of the Black Panther Party. And she told why, too. Okay.
Let's see. I'm going to skip to some of her. Wow. I'm going to read what you just put in there in a minute, Wikipedia scholarship. But let me get into Angie Davis' education at Brandeis University. Davis was awarded a scholarship to Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts, where she was one of three Black students in her freshman class. She initially felt alienated by the isolation of the campus, but soon she made friends with foreign students. She encountered the Frankfurt School philosopher Hubert Marcuse at a rally during the Cuban Missile Crisis and then became his student. In a television interview, she said, "Herbert Marcuse taught me that it was possible to be an academic, an activist, a scholar, and a revolutionary." She worked part-time to earn enough money to travel to France and Switzerland before she went on to attend the 8th World Festival of Youth and Students in Helsinki, Finland. She returned home in 1963 to an FBI interview about her attendance at the communist-sponsored festival. During her second year at Brandeis, she decided to major in French and continue her intensive study of Sartre. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Anyway, Davis was accepted by the Hamilton College Junior Year in France program, and she wrote in her autobiography, she managed to talk Brandeis into extending financial support via her scholarship. Classes were initially at Maritz and later at the Sorbonne in Paris. She and other students lived with a French family. It was at Barrett's that she received news of the 1963 Birmingham church bombing committed by the members of the KKK, an occasion that deeply affected her because she wrote, she was personally acquainted with the 8 young victims. Excuse me. During completion of her degree in French, Davis realized her major interest was in philosophy. She became particularly interested in the idea of Herbert Marcuse, and on her return to Brandeis, she set in on his course without asking for credit. Marcuse, she wrote, turned out to be approachable and helpful. Davis began making plans to attend the University of Frankfurt for graduate work in philosophy. In 1985, she graduated magna cum laude, a member of the Phi Beta Kappa. Let's see. Davis earned her master's degree from San Diego campus and her doctorate in philosophy from Humboldt University in East Berlin in Germany.
Davis was an acting assistant professor in the philosophy department at UCLA beginning in 69. At that time, she was also known as a radical feminist and activist and a member of the Communist Party and an associate of the Black Panther Party. The Board of Regents of California urged by then California Governor Ronald Reagan, fired her from her job in 1969 because of her membership in the Communist Party. The Board of Regents was censured by the American Association of University Professors for their failure to reappoint Davis after her teaching contract expired. She was later rehired after legal action was taken. All right, that's one part of what I'm going to read. All right, let's see. In 1970, Davis became the third woman on the FBI most wanted list when she was charged with conspiracy, kidnapping, and homicide due to her alleged participation in an escape from the Marion County Hall of Justice. She evaded the police for 2 weeks before being captured, tried, and acquitted of all charges 18 months later. And, Erd, you wanted to add something here?
I sure did. You know, when she was on the run, they were looking for the Angela that we know from buttons and pictures and stuff with a big fro. When they caught homegirl had straightened her hair. Her hair was past her shoulders. She had on makeup. She was dressed all dainty and feminine and stuff. They didn't know who they had captured. I just had to add that.
She continued a career of activism and has written several books. A principal focus of her current activism is the state of prisons within the U.S. Davis unsuccessfully rallied against the 1995 Million Man March, arguing that the exclusion of women from this event necessarily promoted male chauvinism and that the organizers of the event, including Louis Farrakhan, preferred women to take subordinate roles in society. She formed the African American Agenda 2000, a small alliance of black feminists in response to the march's growing popularity. Her actions arguably injured her previously strong popularity among African Americans. That's very interesting. Now, some of the books she has written is If They Come in the Morning, Voices of Resistance, Frame Up, The Opening Defense Statement, Angela Davis, an Autobiography, Women, Race, and Class, Violence Amongst Women and Ongoing Challenge to Racism, Women, Race, and Politics, Blues, Legacies, and Black Feminism, and there's a few others. But I want to get into some of what this sister, some of her more recent works in terms of race and class, because it's ironic how these two things meet up. And a lot of times, we don't talk about it. So, black women and activism from suffrage to civil rights. In Women, Race, and Class, Angela Davis discusses the origin of women's rights movement in the U.S. and discusses the significance of Elizabeth Cady Stanton's work to mobilize large numbers of women during the 19th century. However, she notes that one of the shortcomings of these movements was their tendency to overlook the needs of black women, as well as white working women. As the Civil War came to an end and a fierce debate erupted over whether or not black men deserved the right to vote before white women had secured this right. Although Davis sympathizes with the concerns of women who were dissatisfied with the 14th Amendment's failure to include women, she feels that their reaction to this event displays the racist undercurrent that existed in women's suffrage movements. These racist sentiments would continue far into the 20th century. As Davis feels that black women have had to constantly struggle against oppression because of both their race and their gender, which has placed them in a unique condition that makes it difficult to find allies in either movement. During the 20th century, with the emergence of civil rights movement, black women were frequently viewed as a threat to their black male counterparts. Davis not only discusses this in her writing, she also lived through it during her work in the 1960s and 70s. However, Davis showed strength despite these criticisms and emerged as a community leader as well as rose to national prominence by running as a vice presidential candidate for the Communist Party in 1980 and 84. Finally, finally, it is important to note that Davis does not feel that black women were the only women who have been marginalized by these movements. She also notes the exclusion of working class women, immigrants, and other minorities from the activist organizations and the detrimental effects of this exclusion. This further demonstrates how Davis' views of liberation is a vision of liberation for all, as she feels oppression must be attacked from multiple angles and not exclusively the areas of race or gender. Now, this is interesting where she gets, yeah, Angela Davis is the shit. The intersection of class, race, and gender, this is the, you know, a very interesting point of hers as well. Throughout her work, Davis notes the importance of the intersection of class, race, and gender for black women in the U.S. Following slavery, black women struggled to be economically successful in a society that greatly limited the opportunities for African Americans as well as women and systematically excluded black women from access to higher education. Many African American women found that one of the few jobs that society offered to them was to work as in white households performing domestic service. Davis discusses how this occupation perpetuated systems of oppression as it limited opportunities for black women while simultaneously exposing them to the threat of sexual abuse from the man of the house. Additionally, sexism in activist organizations has made it difficult for working women as well as black women to have voices equal to their male counterparts in addressing various issues of oppression. Because Davis feels that categories of race, gender, and class are not discrete, they must be explored where they overlap. This does not mean ignoring the separate causes of oppression. It instead involves acknowledging the areas where they separate, where these separate struggles can find common ground and thus become stronger than they would be divided. She also spoke about reproductive rights. Birth control is an individual choice. Safe contraceptive methods as well as abortion was necessary as a fundamental prerequisite for the emancipation of women. Angela Davis feels that reproductive rights are an integral aspect of the liberation of black women as well as other disadvantaged women. The notion of reproductive rights is frequently associated with the abortion debate of the 20th century, but this concept extends back much further. For Davis, the idea of reproductive rights in the 19th century was simply the right of a woman to exert power over her own body and to choose whether or not she wanted to have intercourse and whether or not she wanted to give birth. Unfortunately, the history of this, of the reproductive right movement often isolated black women, and Davis feels that in order to gain momentum for this movement today, it is important to acknowledge why women of color might be reluctant to support reproductive rights. Margaret Sanger was a chief advocate of reproductive rights and is most well known for her development of birth control for women during the 20th century. Unfortunately, this development coincided with the rise of the eugenics movement, which advocated for sterilization of the less fit individuals in order to prohibit procreation of people who might be undesirable in society. The notion of sterilization of certain groups in society is atrocious, and Davis notes that this practice continued well into the late 20th century and disproportionately targeted women of color. In this way, Davis feels that women of color might be skeptical of reproductive rights and birth control because they link these movements with sterilization and the fear of genocide of minority populations. However, Davis claims that this connection must be severed as birth control is in fact a way for women of color to empower themselves by taking control of their body. If women of color advocate for reproductive rights, they can choose to have children on their own terms rather than bringing children into a world at a point in their lives where they are not ready to take care of them. Angela Davis claims that women of color should fight for the cause of reproductive rights so they can take control of their bodies and further empower themselves. So, there was one other thing I wanted to point out. Crap, I hope I can get to it. Well, it might come back up to me later. But the thing I want to say about Angela Davis is that being in the black conscious or the black power movement, the only thing that you really heard about Angela Davis coming from that perspective being that it's mostly guided by black men, and for the most part, unless black women within that movement in the past and currently take
control of what they want to be taught and what they're interested in, you only really get books that are written by men or from a perspective that the men within that movement give to you. So, again, unless we start to take control over what we want to learn in every way, shape, or form, we're not going to know the truth about a lot of these sisters and what they stand for. Now, I bring that up because me being in that community, I didn't have a lot of background on, the Black Panthers and this, that, and the third. I knew the historical standpoint, meaning I knew that Black people were the first people on the planet. You know, I knew a lot of that history, but I didn't necessarily know the Black Panther piece of it, okay? So the only thing I heard about Angela Davis was, oh, she's a lesbian, she's a dyke, she's a feminist, and they would keep throwing this feminist word around like it was, you know, the worst word in the world. Yeah, and I'm like, okay, well, if I'm a woman and I'm female, what exactly is that, you know, what's so bad about speaking from a perspective of being Black and being a woman, since that's exactly what I am? I can't really separate one from the other. We don't have the capability of choosing to either be Black or woman. We're both. So I just wanted to touch on that. It seems ironic that sometimes they use a woman's choice of her sexuality as a means to use sisters to go against other sisters. And I'm not a proponent of that because I don't have nothing to do with what another sister chooses to do in her bedroom. That's her business. But as Black women, we cannot allow anybody to come in and make us fight against one another because of a personal choice we made. And that's all I'm going to say on that note.
All I wanted to point out is if you notice, most of the sisters that we read about today, they dedicated their life to helping people, period, our people, period, you know, whether it be men or women. But furthermore, they also dedicated their life to gaining knowledge, regardless of what the source was or was not, you know what I mean? They went to school, they did whatever. And I'm not saying you necessarily have to go to school, but I guess why I keep reiterating this is you need to read this stuff yourself. Don't let someone, I don't care what their gender is, tell you something and you take it for that's the blind truth. Because it seems to me that a lot of sisters in the current conscious movement, it's almost like they're being discouraged from reading certain things, or the information is purposely being withheld from them. They, you know, of course they're going to tell you soul on ice. Of course they're going to tell you what's Naeem Akbar's don't, know thyself. You know, and of course they're going to give you Nile Valley contributions. They're going to give you that, but there's so many other books that you really could get into to get a full perspective. Like, to me, the one, it's not the only, but one of the most wonderful things about being a female is that, for the most part, you have the ability to see the whole picture. You have that 360-degree vision. And unfortunately, we women limit ourselves by just either take what somebody teaches us, like, you know, that's my brother, he ain't going to lie to me, he, you know what I mean, he's going to give me the good. Well, he might not know, you know, or worse, he does know and he doesn't want you to know. You know, one of the scholars that we talked about recently who went on a whole rampage about why we shouldn't read and stuff, you know, that's kind of scary to me that a brother who came out of a Black woman's womb would say that another sister shouldn't read. Anyway, so I just want to stress
that.
Well,
it's apparent why any man would tell a woman not to read. Because to me, if you're telling me not to read, it's obvious that you think I'm going to bump into something you don't want me to have access to.
Exactly. I understand that, but I think my issue is this, you know, I'm going to use the words that somebody always, like, if me and a crazy person, and I know that other person is crazy, and they're like, hey, come follow me, and I follow him and we get lost, who's really crazy? You know what I'm saying?
Yo, ass.
We know better. So I just want to, you know, I'm not blaming the victim. Again, we didn't take no part of what went down in the past, of course. Well, some of us did, actually. Let me not even say that. Some of us did sell out our own sisters. But at the same time, we're supposed to know better. You know what I'm saying? We the smart ones. We got that 360 vision, like I said. We know better. We have that vision, and we have intuition. So use it. Don't let anybody teach you anything. You come to your own conclusion. You don't have to agree with me or another sister, but you come to your – you do the research, and you come to your own conclusion. Do not let these brothers tell you not to read. Do not let these brothers just tell you one side of the story. You get out there, and you find this information yourself and come to your own conclusion.
Now, I want to bring up something that was spoken or typed in the chat room. Dr. Clark said that Mulana Karinga put a water hose up a sister's vagina and turned the water on for torture.
That's not all, Mulana. Okay. Oh, I'm glad that you brought
and
that
then
up.
And he also was a – go ahead.
I am very, very glad that you brought that up because I've – never, and I'm not trying to offend anybody who may be listening in the chat room or on the phone or whatever, but me personally, I never really got down with Kwanzaa, and I'm going to tell you why. A, there's no holiday on the continent called Kwanzaa, you know what I mean? This was a made-up thing, but I understood why he wanted to do that, but at the same time, I couldn't get down with it because there was no holiday like that, but then I knew what he did to women, and this was before I even really got into goddess studies. But anyway, long story short, I'm going to start with the woman. That's the worst thing he did. But anyway, he held two women, not just one. He held two women hostage, like locked up and chained up in his house, him and another brother, while they repeatedly sexually abused them and beat them. I mean, all types of various. Matter of fact, you can find the court records now. I mean, I hate to direct you to these kind of sites, but the thing is, I found it on a racist site, but the thing is, they had the court documents. You know what I'm saying? They didn't just type it. It was the court documents. Like, you had to go to whatever link, and you can pull up the court documents yourself. And when you sit there and read what Mulana Karinga did to these females, and I don't care what he said they did to him or didn't do to him, it was disgusting and it was vile. You don't do that to another human being. And so, anyway, he said that he did it because they were traitors or whatever and whatnot. But he held them for, like, 2-3 days, 4 days. Don't give me the line. But he held them for more than 2 or 3 days and repeatedly raping them and torturing them. And, I mean, all types of disgusting stuff. Go read the court documents. It's disgusting. And so, anyway, I can never get down with that. Furthermore, going back to your girl, who is it, Erica Huggins, Mulana Karinga had another group called the United Slaves, and so they were like, you know, this is so ridiculous, but, okay, they both were supposed to be similar, the Black Panthers and the United Slaves or whatever, trying to free black people, but they had beef for whatever freaking reason, like they were the Bloods and Crips, and so that whole incident where Erica's husband got shot is blamed on him. And matter of fact, they even said that Mulana Karinga was an FBI agent. And so, but anyway, I also want to go to, so since we're talking about Mulana Karinga or whatever, you read in the Angela Davis joint that since she was associated with the Black Panthers, that Ronald Reagan really wanted her to get fired and got her fired until she sued and got back her job, right? Only for being associated with a political organization. Now, Mulana Karinga tortured two women and went to jail for it. And I want you to tell me what job at what university he holds right now. So are you telling me he can get a felony? So a woman can just be associated with a group, but a man can torture two black women and be convicted of it and serve time in jail, and he's still got a good position at a, if I'm not mistaken, a Southern California university, a big one, a good one, director of Africana Studies or something of that nature. I don't know about the rest of the sisters. I wish I was in a chat room to see what was going on, but that bothers me. And so I could never support Kwanzaa. I couldn't support him. And matter of fact, one time I spoke on it, and the brothers attacked me, saying, like, well, that's Black Panther misinformation. I'm like, hey, the sister said that she did it.
The sister said that he did it. And the stuff that he was saying he did to her and what her homegirl vouched that he did to her, that's disgusting. Nobody, I don't even see how anybody could make no shit up like that unless they were a man. If they were both females, I doubt they were lying. Anyway, I'm sorry. Did you have something to say about that? You just got me on a rant, and I just went for it.
Girl, I appreciate your rant because it's shit like this. I'm sorry. I guess I'm supposed to have some tact. Well, let me readjust my tact and fix my language. It's shit like this.
Right, right. And see, but you know what? That's so funny that we don't know that.
I'm offended by all these things that are allowed to go on in the conscious movement that attack women, attack black women for voicing their opinions, not agreeing, you know, with things and not wanting to go along and not wanting to be submissive. You know, it's ironic to me how the same ideology from, you know, church and mosque and synagogues come right across to the so-called black power or black conscious movement, and they kind of sort of come at women like, you know, the black woman is powerful, she's this and that, and she allows the black man to be queen, you know, because she's the power. I mean, the black man to be king because she's the power.
Said it right.
She allows
drama queen.
That's the most, I know I said it right. Anyway, it's like that's the most, that's a whole lot of game that's run on women, you know, and they be sitting around like, oh, my gosh, he's just breaking this stuff down. He's so sexy. I think I want to give him some. What?
You know what? You know what? I forget. You know, I didn't come from a Christian standpoint, so that's not the thing that gets me. The thing to me that's the most disappointing about all of this, and I want to reiterate, I am not, nor have I ever been a lesbianka. I have a son. I like men. They look good. They smell good and stuff. But the biggest thing that disappoints me, especially with the black conscious community, is forget Christianity, forget Islam, forget all the religions. But the same shit, since you said it, I'm going to say it, the same shit that they tell me that the white man does to us, you can relate all of that shit to what they done to us as women. So that's, for me, that's what really gets me. Like, are you serious? This whole time you've been selling me wolf tickets about the white dude. And don't get me wrong, like I said earlier, of course, there's institutional racism. There's a system in place to keep us down. I know that. I'm not saying it's not that. However, okay, I'm about to use another bad word. The fuck shit about it is the fact that everything that I've ever said about what white people do to us, I can now apply that to what black men have done to us. And I have a son. I love my father, all types of shit. And that shit is the biggest, most hurtful, disappointing, angering thing ever about the whole situation. I don't care about Christianity. I don't care about Islam. I don't care about none of that. The worst thing in the world to me is the fact that if you really sit there and think about all the shit, especially if you're coming from a black power perspective, all the shit, you'd be like, oh, the white man this, the white man that, blah, blah, blah. You can apply that to a brother that a brother would do to you. We're not talking about him doing it to a white woman. No, we're talking about him doing it to you. That, for me, is the most disappointing thing in the world. That joke makes me mad right there. That joke made me be like, you know what, let's just bring the flood back and we'll start all over.
The funny part is what trips me out is that some of our women are so blindsided by YouTube celebrities that it's like, I'm just going to say it. So just because somebody makes videos on YouTube and they seem to be popular in the conscious community, that automatically gives them a fucking coochie coupon?
To me, I
don't
know.
What the fuck?
I'm a hater.
I ain't hating on nobody. And a sister can do what she chooses to do. Because I think and I know that the black woman is God. So whichever form she chooses to manifest herself, if she want to be a sacred harlot or do what she do, that's her business. You know, go ahead, sister, do your thing. Just be a woman about yours. All I'm saying is we should have some value about ourselves. And when I say value, I mean, he shouldn't just be able to get something just because his name is blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, he shouldn't be able to give you, you know, you
I'm
shouldn't
sorry.
Be able to give him your room just for some...
Because he made some YouTube videos?
But you
and
know
because
what?
He talked on a blog talk radio show?
It goes back, though, to what I think you and I was talking about before. It's, you know, long story short, a lot of women that I know, even if they're not aware of it,
have low self-esteem, personally. That's what I think. But see, I think the whole, you know, there's a couple of sisters on the Black Wooniverse that sometimes I read their posts and I'm like, damn, girl, you don't have no self-esteem. Before I knew I was a goddess, I'd be like, nigga, I'm the shit. Even if I was looking like trash. But the sad thing is I look at a lot of other women, and I personally think it comes back down to self-esteem. Because, again, just like you said, I find men sexy, but my whole thing in life is master of my own domain. You ain't going to get it just because you ran some game or just because you read the same books I do and you're on YouTube. No, no, there's got to be something. There's got to be an exchange or something, tangible. I can't take that YouTube video to Bank of America. You know what I'm saying? Until I can take that YouTube video to Bank of America, I don't want to hear none of that. But anyway, I just think that sisters, long story short, had low self-esteem and we're conditioned. Again, you have to realize we're chattel. I mean, that might sound hurtful to whoever's listening, but we're chattel. I mean, as soon as we're born, we are domesticated. And there's nothing wrong with having children and nothing like that. I don't want people to say that. But as soon as we're born, what are we given? We're given dolls that shit on themselves. Why the fuck would I want a doll that shits and piss on itself? Why do I want a Susie home oven as a little girl? Why do I need that? Why do I need a Barbie doll whose main thing in life is to get a Ken doll? Like, think about how we're domesticated. I look at my son's toys. My son got Power Rangers and Iron Man, and I mean, to him, it's all a game. He could be a green Martian from another planet if he wants to. If you look at the female child's toys, we yeah.
are
domesticated. I mean, I hate to put it like that, but think about it like a dog. We are domesticated like dogs to think a certain way. All of the stories that are for girls, you know, Princess and the Frog or Mulan or even Sacagawea, even though that in real life Sacagawea was being brutalized by white people and stuff like that, it's still a love story. Like, what? Excuse me? Like, we're always taught that somebody's going to jump out the sky and save us, some man, of course. The thing that is belittling that I see from our perspective is when we look at things within this movement that we're speaking about right now, because we talked about, you know, the Black Panther Party and the sisters that contributed, and of course, so our conversation is about the Black Power movement and the Black Conscious movement, you know, and if it doesn't apply, don't say shit. If it ain't you, don't say nothing. But if it is you, nigga, get mad. Who gives a shit? But the thing that bothers me the most is that women in that movement are trained to think that their contribution is being a mother, and that's the highest thing. They only talk about, you know, oh, the Black woman, you know, births a child, and y'all stay at home, and you do this and that for the child, and that her whole life is given up for children. And then they also tell you, well, you know, that's your role. You're supposed to, you know, build, you know, birth the nation and teach the children. And that Black woman got so much on her plate that when these brothers spitting out these books, if she's busy trying to hold her household down in that particular movement, she ain't even got time in most cases to read these books. And that's what they're banking on. They want to keep women so busy that she don't even have time to find out who and what she really is. And the fact that she's doing all the work while they sitting around making fucking videos on YouTube.
And see, but that also goes back to taking control of your body. Like, don't get me wrong. I think that Margaret Sanger was a racist, and I do believe that she, you know, I do believe that she personally, you know, didn't want to see Black people make it and stuff like that. Don't get me wrong. But at the same time, though, I don't care what you say, and this is going to sound harsh, but when you don't have control of your own reproductive system, that is a form of slavery. Like, have you ever seen women who
got,
like, 1,000 babies and they're just worn down. And it's not that they don't love their kids, and it's not like that kids aren't great. You know, kids are great. But at the same time, you should be allowed to make your own decisions
of how you're going to do it. And regardless if we're like, oh, that's not the African thing to do, that's a damn lie, because I just read something in ancient Egyptian culture, like if the women didn't want to get married, they knew how, I mean, have a baby, they mixed up a concoction, so that didn't happen. So
that's
anyway,
right.
Long story short,
that's
your body. That's your body, and that's your decision. Now, just like you said with the sex thing, if you want to have a lot of children, that's good. That's on you. That might be your calling. But don't let somebody else tell you what you should and should not do with your own body and your own mind.
I mean, from your diet to how you wear your hair and, you know, your role, and they like to try to say, well, the role of the man is this and the role of the woman is this, and that women are trying to, you know, be too controlling and this, that, and the third. I'm like, yo, I pay my bills.
But see, that's the bullshit.
And even if I didn't pay my bills, I'm the boss of me, not nobody else. The whole
hey, but that's the to me, that's the bullshit of the whole thing. They're telling that's the whole wolf the wolf ticket right there, because they'll be like, our role is this and your role is this. You're supposed to take care of the home and I'm the provider. But then in the next breath they'd be like, well, I can't get it. But wait. But in the next breath they say, the white man's stopping me from getting a job. So, nigga, okay, our roles are effectively reversed. So shouldn't you be cooking? Shouldn't you be cleaning? Shouldn't you, you know what I'm saying? Our roles are effectively reversed. Like, how the fuck are we going to stay in the same role if you're not living up to your end of the bargain? There's no balance in that. Where is the ma'at? Can I get a little reciprocity out of this motherfucker? Now, let me tell you.
The women
might get mad.
Reciprocity
hey.
And balance only applies when you need to stay in your place, sister.
Well, you're right.
That's
why they should have never taught me how to read.
You shouldn't be reading. That's why you shouldn't
that's
be reading.
That's absolutely
that's the man's
right.
job to read, and he comes to you and teach you what you need to know. You didn't know that, sister?
And you know what? Honestly, I know, you know, sisters take it for whatever they want to, but, you know, if you know, the other thing is a lot of brothers in the conscious community be like, oh, he's in Hollywood, so blah, 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 he's so bad. Well, you know what? The dude in Hollywood, Jay-Z can afford to have a wife to stay at home. You know what I'm saying? He can afford it. Nigga, what? I will stay home. If you give me access to that Black American Express card, I will stay home. You can afford it. Like, the thing, a lot of sisters are like, oh, no, and all that stuff. I can already hear it in my soul. But let me tell you, just like Sister Latava said, marriage has always been a financial arrangement. I posted this book, The History of a Wife, and if you read that book, you will understand it's always been a financial arrangement. Always been a financial arrangement. The only difference is the woman's the ability to control that financial arrangement has been eroded away for centuries. You know, when we switched to the patriarchy thing, our father started getting the money that was really supposed to come to us. And then if you look at, like, you know, I'm about to just briefly touch on the polygamy thing, but don't ask me no questions if you don't want to hear what I got to say about polygamy. But just like the polygamy thing or whatever, if you look at modern cases in Africa, and we are modern now, a lot of y'all feels like we're going to go back to some ancient Egyptian shit and we're going to be wearing those pharaoh hats on our head. No, nigga, we live in today. Anyway, if you look at what's going on today on the continent or whatever, whatnot, the women have to fight. It doesn't matter if you are on paper or if you are not on paper, if you're the whatever, the second, third wife, and you're only a civil arrangement, it's like the courts are even to the point where it's like if the man dies or something happens, his money, no question, goes to the kids. But the women are sitting there living like paupers and having a fight. And a lot of women don't fight because they don't have any recourse in the system. And it's not even just in Africa. I mean, Indian women, we're not even talking about polygamous relationships here. Indian women, they're having an issue right now in India with the women whose husband dies. All the money goes to the kids. And then the kids don't, the male children are expected, you get rid of your daughters, remember. And most of these indigenous cultures that we're talking about now, you get rid of your daughter. Once your daughter gets married, it's almost like she's a non-entity, almost. So anyway, you get rid of your daughter, and you're sitting there thinking that your son is going to take care of you, and that nigga's kicking you out the house, taking your husband's money and kicking you out. So we got all of these women who paid their dues in these long marriages kicked out on the streets by their own sons. So don't lie to yourself about what this is and what this ain't. You got to look out for you. And if you're going to, you know, like my Aunt Peggy used to say, Don't let no nigga snore all up in your face when he can't pay no bills or do nothing for you. Are you crazy? Anyway, I'm sorry. I went on a rant again.
I mean, I understand, you know, what you're saying. Trust me. I agree with what you're saying. You know, my thing is, I got to repeat what you said earlier, be master of your domain. If you, you know, want to get married and you want to be with a man, you know, make sure that man is respectful of you, you know, and that you get what you want out of your business arrangement. See, the thing is, a lot of us look at this thing called love. And I tend to agree
with you. It's a four-letter word. Think about
that. What the hell does love have to do with it? Because love does not pay the bills. I'm sorry. I'm not sorry. It just doesn't pay the bills. Now, we got a caller on the line.
Love is a four-letter
word. I'm going to give out the call-in number right quick, 646-716-7675. We have about 9 minutes remaining on the live stream. So if you want to hear the remainder of the show, make sure that you call in. Again, the number is 646-716-7675. I am going to go to the phone line because I see a hand raised. Here, area code 937, could you let us know who you are?
Hey, how y'all doing? I'm liking y'all show. I'm loving it. I just want to know who said we shouldn't be reading.
Who is
it? Please call it.
I'm sorry, what's your name, sis?
Wikipedia scholarship, Sister Natira.
Oh, okay, I already know who this is then. I already know who this is then. How you doing, sis?
I'm wonderful.
What's up, Wiki?
Who said we don't want to read? Damn.
Oh, you already know who said we don't supposed to read. Brother Phil Valentine said we not supposed to read.
Oh, please. He couldn't even keep Queen out full, so I know he ain't no man. Okay, I was just wondering who the hell was saying that.
Yeah, he said we should read. See,
sister,
said we should read
explain
the beer.
Sister, you can't read because your vitamin A will be depleted and it will cause
no.
a beard to grow.
No. Let me do it. No, this is what he's doing.
Okay,
I'm going to
let you do it. I'm
going to do verbatim because I lost a lot of time of my life trying to kill that dude over that statement. So anyway, this is what he did. He goes, if you look at the women, and he was stuttering while he said that too, so you got to get that down too. He was like, so if you look at the women up there in academia or whatever, if you look at them, most of them got beards. And why? He was like, because sister, if you read it, oh, and when he said sister, he got an assistant's face who must have paid money to go see him tell that shit to her face. Anyway, he goes, sister, he was like, because when you read, it depletes your vitamin A, which messes with your estrogen, which will make you grow a beard, and all of this other shit. And so anyway, I went on
a
big.
Oh.
Oh, yeah, Wounded Womb. Oh, y'all can look it up. Wounded Womb. YouTube.
Wounded Womb.
Wounded Womb.
Uh-huh. But doesn't he have a $80 book called The Wounded Womb? And in order for women to see what he's talking about, they got to read his big-ass book. So
good question.
I'm trying to figure out how many hairs these women that grew on his chin while he was reading his $80 book.
Hey, sister, see, that's the thing. You know, he had that. You gotta have your man read it to you. That's what it is.
Okay.
I mean, but he apparently, if you're familiar with the brothers, like y'all was speaking on so eloquently tonight, because I was listening to these sisters converse on such intelligent reasonings and discussions. But if you're familiar with that brother, for years he's been known as a womanizer and a pimp of the word. You know, this whole, I don't know what conscious movement is. We have not moved any damn where, you know. You know, when you talk about Africa, transcontinental Africa, you know, we in the diaspora and we suffer the same thing they suffer there, which is rape, whether it be forced rape, whether it be gang rape, whether it be rape as a means of war. Whether it be rape as a corrective procedure for lesbian women, whether it be rape after a natural disaster, whether it be rape in jail, whether it be rape as a child, whether it be rape of some brother running around talking about he know everything and manipulating you out some pussy. You know, rape is what we suffer from as black women, and we are supposed to suffer in silence and allow ourselves to be raped in whatever this conscious community is. Now, me personally, I love my pussy, my body, you know, and I think that when you enjoy sex for yourself or when you enjoy your body yourself, you know, and whether you give yourself willingly to one of these brothers out here, they think they didn't got one up. I was looking for the same that you was looking for, you know, but if you empowered like that, something's supposed to be wrong with you. But I just couldn't believe somebody, y'all kept saying that somebody said sisters shouldn't be reading. But
yeah, you can't read.
And it's so funny.
I hope you weren't reading. Were you reading in the chat room?
Nah.
It was so funny that you just said that, because the funny thing is, like in groupthink with the brothers, if you're empowered or you're the master of your damn man, like, yo, this is just what it is, this is just what I want out of the deal. You know, in group, when they with the group, they're like, I can't stand her. But when you by yourself, oh, my God, they can't. They taste you. I'm telling you, my whole life, the brothers that I've ever messed with, the ones who are always on their best behavior were the ones that I abused. I just didn't have the patience to keep the abuse up, you know what I mean, because I wouldn't be mad all the time. But I'm telling you, brothers got a problem. Like, the brothers that treated me the best were always the ones where I was like, ah, get the hell out of my face. I don't like you.
You got to really take it a step further, because what Sigmund Freud discussed was penis envy amongst so-called feminist women. And what it really is womb envy. You see a lot of transgender black men. You see a lot of homosexual black men in heels. You see a lot of black men who hate the power of the pussy and hate the fact that a woman got the right to choose who she want to lay with or who she want to show her pussy to. They hate that. You whore. You feminist. You bitch. You aborting our children. But, nigga, you ain't going to take care of these 13 million kids that's in the foster care system now.
God. And so if I choose not to give birth right now because it's my choice, I can mix up a little something and do what I got to do. If I choose to want to explore my sexuality and I want to, you know, carry myself in whatever manner I choose to, that is my choice. You know,
or
if
you choose to share your reproductive health with sisters who have hysterectomies because some nigga that gave her some vaginal disease that's that made her have an early hysterectomy where she can't have children, and you decide, okay, I can't raise this child, but this sister can, that's within our power. You know, and I just had to chime in on y'all because y'all was really going in, and I appreciate the show, but, you know, if I can get some pussy, get a life.
Well, thank you for calling in, sis. I'm going to open up, Lynn, I'm going to open up your line, and Goddess Network, your line is open, and I just wanted to see if, you know, y'all want to get in on this discussion. Again, we have about 2 minutes remaining in the live stream. The call-in number is 646-716-7675. It's just irritating to me. The things that have gone on, the things I've witnessed in this, and I have to say so-called conscious movement, I have to, you know, go back to what Wiki just finished saying a couple minutes ago. You know, supposedly it's a movement, but we ain't moved nowhere. And ironically, or just as planned, so I'm not going to say ironically, we talked about a couple of the sisters within the movement, and the funny part is we're dealing with the exact same issues as black people and as black women. In fact, for black women, it has gotten worse. And then we listen to people talk about going back to the continent, and as the sister just mentioned earlier, we're dealing with rape on the continent, and here we're also dealing with, you know, genital mutilation.
They're getting beat in the streets and nobody stops them. I mean, it's a lot of stuff that the African woman on the continent is dealing with that the, you know, African American, the women in the diaspora, I guess, are not, well, most of us were not put up with. So Anyway, I don't want to go back there to get my ass whooped, personally. Y'all can keep that.
I wanted to add this in, too. And, yeah, I enjoyed the show, learned some other stuff. And to me, it's just logical why these black women would join the feminist in any other damn movement to get away from these lying-ass black men, because this is just a damn shame. But the sister posted something in the chat room, and then from what the other sister just said, I watched Pam Grier interview. I haven't read her book, but I'm going to purchase it now. But in the interview, it's on YouTube, she spoke of her going to her OBGYN, and her OBGYN telling her that she had cocaine on her uterus. And she links this to having sex with Richard Pryor, and indirectly, thinks that the reason why she had cancer is because of it. And she stated all this in the interview. And I'm just thinking about what the sister posted and what the sister just spoke about sexuality and all that other stuff. It's just a damn shame is what it is. It's just a damn shame that she had to go through all that. And she is seen as a black revolutionary. She's played these black revolutionaries in these black exploitation films. And the whole time, I mean, just these black men that she had a relationship with, one of them, I mean, just cancer on, not cancer, but cocaine on her uterus. That's a damn shame. I for the life of me, don't understand why women stay in this. I just don't get it. I know y'all tried to explain it to me before, but to me, this just makes no logical sense. But that's all I wanted to say.
See, the funny part about it is there's a big, in this movement, there's a big push to try to keep black women from really getting into what some of the feminists study. Because if we really get into what they study, we realize a whole lot of things. A lot of things start to become very crystal clear, you know. And, wow. It's just so much that sisters really need to get into. They need to, you know, really read and research. They need to really know their bodies, you know. And, again, the black woman's body is a temple. So before somebody step in the temple, they need to be clean, they need to be purified, and they need to bring some offerings. Whatever you determine your offerings are for your temple, that's up to you. But can't nobody walk in the temple empty-handed and unclean and spreading themselves all around. You know, I'm sorry. Black women have got to have some self-esteem. They have got to know their worth, you know, and just because a man treats you like shit don't mean you are shit. If he treats you like that, then he don't know who and what you are, and you ought to know who and what you are enough not to deal with him because he's an asshole.
Because he don't think he is shit. See, that's the other thing. Like, this is the cycle of this low self-esteem thing. What we don't realize is the brother that comes at you, who's all in your face trying to get some of your good stuff, but he treats you like shit, he has low self-esteem, and he wants you to feel like he feels about himself. So, you know, I have much respect for Francis Cress Welsin and stuff with the ISIS papers because, you know, it exposed a lot of light on a lot of stuff that goes down with black men in particular. However, the bad thing about the ISIS papers is that was almost like the excuse. Like, you guys are just so infantile because what the hell has been going on to you that you can't do no better and stuff like that. It almost gave them that crutch, like they're supposed to act like that. And so my thing is the women... I got to say two things. So my thing is for the women who are coming into this, you know, however you float sexually, your relationships with men or whatever, that's your business. Just be, like I always say, the master of your domain. Do not let no nigga pimp you. Like, you are the prize. He is not the prize. I mean, you know what? This morning I was watching a documentary about weed, okay? Weed, cannabis. And the crazy shit about it was, even in the cannabis film, they said the female strain of cannabis is good for everything, rope, paper, smoking, whatever you want to do with the female cannabis, you can do it. But you know what the male cannabis is good for? Just smoking.
You can't do nothing with it. So long story short, let that sit with you and understand that you're the prize. The second thing I wanted to point out with the kindness community, too, though, is just like I say with white people at this point, white people ain't worried about us Negroes no more. That's why we be all on these internet sites talking shit about them. They don't care because, you know, we're not going to organize with, as it is, as a conscious movement. They don't care about none of that. They're not even a threat. But the thing that's the issue, another issue that we sometimes don't like to point out, but, you know, a lot of women in the conscious movement, and some elders, actually a lot of elders, are selling you wolf tickets and selling you BS about what it is to be a woman. I'm going to put it out there. Yeah, I'm going to put it out there.
I want to talk about the, I won't tell you to stop. I want to talk about the African thing to do, number one. And then, two, I want to talk about this polygamy bullshit they keep trying to, because I know that's what you alluded to. Why is it black women need to understand it? In this conscious movement, they keep trying to sell us out on the African thing to do. Can somebody pull up a fucking dictionary and show me what the African thing to do is in the damn dictionary?
Exactly.
Can you Google it, Wikipedia, dictionary, goddamn physiology online? Tell me what the hell the African thing to do is, because Africa's a damn landmass. It's not one country. And none of the
tribes always
on
been,
there do the exact same
it's
thing.
Always been that big. It's always been that big, and it's always had a diverse array of different cultures. I mean, the funny thing is, you know, a lot of people, period, are so smart they're stupid. Like, we it's almost like we can't apply certain knowledge to other shit. It's like, okay, boom. It wasn't just Egypt. Ancient Egypt is not Africa. That's just a small, tiny piece of the land. And let's keep it honest. Everything was not all peace in the valley on the continent. You know what I mean? We like to blame a lot of stuff on white people, but shit was not all peace on the continent before white people got there. I mean, I don't know about you, but like 1,000 years before white people came, Nubia and Egypt were beefing, right? You know what I mean? It went to war 2 or 3, 4 or 5 times. You know, everything was not all good. But anyway, I have a problem with some of these elder women because I refuse to believe that they, being in the game as long as they have not experienced some form of sexism or come across some books that we've come across or just come across anything that's like, wait a minute, something ain't right. But then for these same women to turn around to the younger generation like, oh, yeah, you need to be in a polygamous relationship because it's the African thing to do. Who cares if the dude ain't worth the toilet paper he wipes his ass with? You know, you just need a man just to get a man. It's like, I don't respect them. So it's a catch-22. Just like the whole reason why I brought up the white people is the brothers, I don't even really think, with the exception of a few, are really even worried about the sisters in the conscious community, like, really getting it because they don't have to do it no more. Because you got other sisters who are perpetuating this cycle. Like, if it's polygamy, if it's, oh, well, this is the African thing to do, you need to submit to your man, or if it's, well, why you got your cleavage showing or why you got a weave or whatever. So you got other women who continue this cycle against us. And too, and I have, to be honest with you, again, men are sexy. They smell nice, believe me. If Idris Elba come in here right now, I'm going to hang up with y'all. But at the same time, we the smart ones. We supposed to know better. So, you know, until we get, I don't have any faith in men understanding this or trying to get together, you know, with us on their own. I have no faith. But women, we supposed to know better. You know what I'm saying? We're not supposed to do this against each other like we do. So, again, we got to get our
shit together. Well, they're enabling it. They're enabling it. They've enabled it their whole life. But I find it interesting that you said that, too, about the ISIS papers, because I feel the exact same way. And it's interesting because I didn't know about Eldridge Cleaver and that he had came out, you know, saying he was a serial rapist. But when I read it, and I hear him deflect responsibility, saying it's this system why he raped these white women. And, of course, he had to practice on black women first.
Okay,
so the system got you raping white women, but you got to practice on raping the black women first. But the very fact that I see that same mentality in a lot of the brothers that are quoting that stuff and the sisters buy it, and then I read the same thing, like you said, in the ISIS papers. They are deflecting responsibility, and as long as they can blame the white man for why they are messed up, they're never going to take responsibility. They're never. And that's why my stance is for black women to leave those organizations. Those men are not going to take responsibility. They will forever say they raped, they mistreat, they walk out on their children all because of the white man. They're going to forever say it. They're going to always say it as long as that crutch is there.
And you know what? The one thing that they did get right is by calling they'll be like, the white man is the devil. You're right, because the devil don't make you do nothing. The devil just gives you a suggestion. So, again, if I suggest to y'all on the phone, y'all should go jump off a bridge and y'all do it, am I really at fault for making the suggestion? No, you should be smart enough not to do that stuff. Anytime that we talk about any issue, whether it's African diaspora or if it's African thing to do, the first thing the brothers say, oh, well, those Africans are crazy because of the white man. No, the white man is not holding this dude's dick and making him rape a baby. I ain't see no white man in that documentary. So, no.
Exactly.
There has to come a time where you take responsibility for what the hell is going on. And you know what? Again, I'm going to point it right at the sisters, like the elder sisters that I was just talking about, too. We should know better. We the smart ones. We have both of our brains, both sides of our brains. We have intuition. So we can't sit there and wait and hope for these dudes to get it together. We got to do it ourselves. However, whatever the plan is, whatever you want to do, if you're just going to do it in your household, I don't care. But you got to get your stuff together and start giving these brothers your power.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, we didn't talk about the sisters tonight. You know, we didn't spoke their names and, you know, gave some more references out to the sisters to do some research about this movement, you know, and the role that sisters played in it, even though a lot of sisters don't get mentioned or, you know, they get kind of sort of mentioned lightly or kind of sort of talked down about. We can put resources out there for people to go do their own research. BlackWombiverse.com, you know, if there are sisters on the line or listening in archives that want to come join the temple, we have a study group, God is Library. I mean, it's not just a spiritual site. And the reason I say that is because a lot of times in this particular movement, the sisters get relegated to just spiritual mothers. And we don't understand that in one token, we're told to be activists and to go, you know, organize. But an activist isn't just a person that organizes. An activist is also a scholar. And we can't leave it up to someone else to teach you what they really don't want you to know about yourself. Because if they wanted you to know things about yourself and they really wanted you to know about science and biology, they would be giving you some books. They would be telling you to go pick up The Redundant Male and The Mysteries of Human Reproduction. They would be telling you about The Secrets of Regeneration and The Great Gray Dragon, which they sell on their own websites.
Hey, you know what?
They'd be telling you about those.
You don't even have to. You don't even have to go that deep with it. I remember when I was working in when I was working in corporate America, I had this book, and it was specific. I got to find the title, but it was specifically about the differences between males and females in a corporate situation at work. And one of the things that was said was the fact that women have the innate ability to be multitaskers and to do everything,
yeah.
But men are not able to do that. But since the corporate America especially is so male-dominant, they're looking at you like you're unorganized or you don't have your shit together because they can only concentrate on one thing at one time. They made a lot of different points, and again, this wasn't necessarily about races, but if you even read that book, and I mean it's a little book and it's just about working, but you will learn so much about how we relate to each other and the differences in how we think. So, I mean, you don't even really have to go all deep into the biology if you are not there yet. But you need to expand your own library besides Know Thyself and the Nile Valley Contributions. I'm not knocking those books. You definitely, you know, if that's what you want to learn, do that. But just expand your library. That's all you got to do. Read different books.
And
get a different book
right,
list. Join a library.
Don't allow someone else to pretty much give you the book list that they think is best for you because you have to learn the way they learn. If your mind is expanding and growing and you're being led to other things you want to study, go do it.
Don't let anybody else make you feel bad about your opinions being different than theirs. You know, nobody has to agree. I mean, there's a such thing as agreeing to disagree and respectfully disagreeing. You know, you do not have to agree with everything somebody else says. You are your own person. You have your own brain, just so you can be a critical thinker. So think about things before you do it, and don't let people, you know, take your power away from you. That's the last thing I got to say before we head out tonight.
Hey,
anybody got anything else to add?
I had a question. Were you Sister Goddess Network, were y'all going to touch on that video from that woman who was RBG today? I think that one was pretty interesting. You know, maybe just a brief blurb about what old girl was going through.
Goddess Network, you want to touch on that one?
Am I still on?
Yeah, you still on?
I've seen that video, and it's a cult mentality. I remember when I was in the Nation of Islam, and Brother Minister said a woman is like a used car. And when a man wanted, he said he's from the roster.
Who said that?
The minister, our local minister, when I was in the mosque. And he said, at the time, he did it because it was his brother who was trying to court me, and I didn't want to court him. But because I had a child already, you know, they felt like you're supposed to be married. You know what I'm saying? And here go a brother who's willing to marry you. So his lecture was centered around kind of around that. And he said, a woman is like a used car. You know, you want to see how many miles she got on her. You want to kick the tires and take her for a test run. So nobody won't know broke down hoopie. And what happens to a lot of us as women, when we all face isolation from being different in American culture and society. And when you are not educated, or when you don't have access to higher education in order to, you know, get that degree and fulfill yourself career-wise, you look for camaraderie. You look for other people who suffer from that same, you know, stigmatized oppression and not being able to accomplish and not having this and that. And when you have different groups and movements, this cultish thing arises. You know, it really pisses me off that people are so gung-ho about Dr. York. I don't care how many books he stole from women and put his name on. You know, I don't care how much information and lectures he even gave. He was accused of one of the worst crimes against children, pedophilia, and they wasn't 16. I've read the documents. These were babies, and he confessed to it. They be so gung-ho about this man. You can't say nothing bad about him. He like Jesus or God. You know, as women, like you sisters are doing a powerful job with the Comedic Science Temple, the Black Womaniverse, because once you get stigmatized and ostracized from the larger community, you know, that's why it's not good to keep berating homosexuality. You have children at 11 years old, you know, in elementary committing suicide because people call them gay, you know, because they're being picked on or looked at as weak, and you have homosexuals now committing suicide because they isolated and ostracized. So as sisters, when we come into these communities, we think we finally got family. We finally got camaraderie. But there is a war against us, you know, and if we don't go into these organizations with that mind frame, we're going to get hurt because we're going to look to people who we think are leaders who are actually just self-aggrandizing, looking for money, looking for somebody to pimp, you know what I'm saying, looking for an easy way to say that they powerful and big without really working for it. You understand what I'm saying? And we get so wrapped up into their personalities that once we realize, damn, this person betrayed my trust. You know, this person touched my baby when I wasn't looking. This person robbed me. Oh my God, this sister just stabbed me in my back because she wants this man who wants me, who in this Black Power movement. You know, that, and then, like I said, I don't I don't know what the Black Power Conscious Movement is, because we're not moving anywhere. There is nobody talking about the investment of stocks and bonds and oil. There's nobody buying property. Sister Lateva.
You got
my sister out of Indianapolis who actually got a place where you can get your warrior retreat. You got your sisters like yourselves who do the goddess retreats. But as a whole, as a group, we ain't moving nowhere. We on the news with Fox News, making an imbecile of ourselves. But look at the Tea Party, and look at how they use their women. Look at Sarah Palin, and look at the Republican Party and how they're parlaying their women. To the, no matter how stupid, no matter how old, no matter how dumb, they put their women at the top of the, because they know that the woman represents their whole nation. You got brothers who will step on your neck, who will berate you, dog you, slander you, everything, bitch, you hoe, you dyke, you baby killer, everything, so that you won't stand up. Because they're supposed to represent the nation. But they're not even about nation. They don't even get along with each other. So, you know, the sister just needs to regroup. I think I checked out her channel. You know, I think she understands the whole concept of life emanating from her and her being the original mother and connecting with that force and really not getting too caught up into the group anymore, the group dynamic. You know, but it really has to take... You have to reprogram yourself, because it's brainwashing and mind control when you get into that type of cultish mentality that you have to be accepted. Fuck them. Come and kiss your ass and keep moving.
That's right.
That's real. That's real. Anyway, we're going to go ahead and end out on that note. I think that's a very opportune time to go ahead and... And out, and I'll holler at our sisters later. You, Miss Lady, Wikipedia scholarship, it would be nice if you could call a sister.
Oh, I will. I got you tonight.
All right.
All right, y'all.
Hi, y'all. Peace.
We will not bow down to our racism. We will not bow down to injustice. We will not bow down to exploitation. I'm gonna stand. I'm gonna stand.
Now this is time for Free Your Mind and Soul.